Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In these dark and turbulent times, Behind the News remains rock-like in its solidity. Two guests, two segments. We'll hear from Emil Torres on the philosophy of the tech moguls and from Daniel Wartell London on the fiscal history of New York City. You may have watched some of the tech moguls, who it should be emphasized have a major beachhead in the Trump administration, and wondered if they really care about human lives. In a sense, they don't. As my next guest, Emil Torres, argues, many of them look to a transhumanist future, where we pathetic sacks of flesh will be replaced by digital beings endowed with superintelligence far greater than our wetware can support. This helps explain their obsession with AI. It's at the core of their human extinctionist preferences. Or more precisely, AGI, artificial general intelligence, one that can do far more than ChatGPT's regurgitation of plagiarized material. My first guest, Emil Torres, has coined an acronym to describe their philosophy, TESCRIAL, which stands for transhumanism, extropianism, singularitarianism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. That's a mouthful, I admit. We'll talk about transhumanism in detail. The second two are basically variations on it. So is cosmism, though with a colonizing space angle. We also talk about rationalism in detail. Effective altruism, which crypto fraudster Sam Bankman-Fried made famous, holds that doing good has to be practical and efficient and not always self-sacrificing. It makes sense under this doctrine to spend your life on Wall Street making lots of money if you use it later in life to do good, though how that good is defined can be mysterious. And long-termism, a topic that comes up but we don't get into detail about, is the doctrine that what really matters is the perspective of millions of years, so any suffering and death now is of no significance if it advances the transhumanist agenda. Emil Torres, quoting their own bio, is a moral philosopher, intellectual historian, and journalist whose work focuses on the ethics of emerging technologies, especially AI and human extinction. In 2023, with Dr. Timnit Gebru, they coined the acronym TESCRIAL to denote a constellation of ideologies that have become very influential within Silicon Valley. And now to explain it all, Emil Torres. TESCRIAL, it's a mouthful. What are the components of the acronym? What does each of these letters stand for? Starting with transhumanism, which is an umbrella concept among some of the others.
Transhumanism is the backbone of the whole TESCRIAL bundle. I've never claimed that it's a pretty word. It's not. But it is useful. The key idea at the very heart of the TESCRIAL worldview is this techno-utopian vision of the future, whereby we develop advanced technologies that enable us to radically re-engineer the human organism, to create a new post-human species. And then beyond that, we will spread beyond Earth, colonize first Mars, and then the rest of the galaxy, and ultimately create these vast computer simulations full of trillions and trillions of digital people. And the whole reason for doing that is that the TESCRIAL worldview instructs us to maximize the total amount of value within the universe. People are the containers or the substrates of value. So the more people you have, the greater total amount of value you could potentially create, right? So that's at the heart of the TESCRIAL worldview.
This value, what is it exactly and who is enjoying it?
So this is a really excellent question. TESCRIALism has been very significantly influenced by an ethical theory called totalist utilitarianism, or sometimes total utilitarianism. There are different theories within utilitarianism about what constitutes value. The most important idea is that utilitarianism takes value to be an impersonal thing. So it's not about value mattering because it benefits some particular person. It could be better thought of as money or wealth. So the more, you know, money or wealth there is, the better off. The analogy breaks down in some ways, but basically it has this impersonal view of value according to which the universe itself is just better if there's more value in it. One interpretation of value would be that it is something like pleasure, pleasurable experiences or happiness, right? So the more happiness or pleasurable experiences the universe contains, the better it becomes. Well, not necessarily for anyone, but merely from what utilitarians refer to as the point of view of the cosmos. So there's this disembodied cosmic eye looking down on the universe, and it judges the universe to be better the more value or the more happiness it contains, and it judges the universe to be worse the less it contains.
There's a weirdly religious angle to that.
There is. And I would say that there's also a kind of capitalist influence, right? So this is what I was clumsily trying to get at before. There's this idea that human beings do not matter in and of ourselves. So we do not have intrinsic value, precisely because, as I mentioned before, we are the containers of value. Utilitarianism, in my view, gets things exactly reversed. We matter for the sake of value, rather than value mattering for the sake of us, which I think is what you were gesturing at earlier. Like, for whom exactly is greater value beneficial?
This is turning me into a really sentimental humanist.
Yeah.
I like to think of myself as a little more disciplined than that, but God, it's going to make me all soppy about the value of humans.
There are plenty of philosophers who say ethics is actually much more personal than utilitarians claim, because utilitarians have this very impersonal, or it's literally called impersonalism, this impersonalist kind of understanding of value. Again, the key idea is that we are just a means to an end. The only end is value, this like weird abstract thing that is somehow quantifiable and should be maximized to the physical cosmic limits. Right. And so we matter just as the conduits through which this value can come into existence. That is a really key idea at the heart of the Tescreal movement.
Musk said recently in a tweet, humans are basically a biological bootloader for a superintelligence of the future.
Yes.
Is this what you're talking about? The humans will make capable this fabulous intelligence, but it will surpass us and leave us totally in the dust.
Yes, exactly. So there are a couple ways to think about this. One is that superintelligence could be really important because it could facilitate the realization of the Tescreal vision of the future. Tescrealists tend to think of everything as an engineering problem. So the reasoning is that if we have a superintelligence, then we have a super engineer. If we have a super engineer, then we can engineer paradise, which is a term that they literally use. Superintelligence will figure out how to colonize space. Like Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, has said, without AGI, artificial general intelligence, we probably cannot colonize space. Superintelligence is going to figure out how to, quote unquote, cure aging so that we get to live forever or upload our minds to computers. But the other key role that superintelligence might play is that it could multiply into a population that simply replaces humanity. Maybe our species is, in a sense, not worthy to fulfill the long-term vision of Tescrealism. And what we need is some population of quote-unquote smarter beings that can actually go out and colonize space and re-engineer, redesign galaxies in order to like harvest all of the energy contained in galaxies to maximize value.
From my limited meat space point of view, these creatures of the future would be something like simulations?
That is one possibility. So once you have digital intelligences, there are two options. One is that they could live in virtual reality worlds. This is what I was hinting at earlier when I talked about building these vast computer simulations full of trillions and trillions of digital people. They would be digital entities, AGIs or superintelligences that just live in a VR world, a simulated universe. Another possibility is that these AI systems occupy something like android bodies or mechanical bodies that enable them to navigate our physical universe. So they're still digital, but rather than existing within simulated worlds, they could exist within our actual world. Part of the vision is you probably have both. So you'd have superintelligences that go out and colonize space, but also build, and I'm quoting some leading figures within the Tescreal movement here, they could also create quote-unquote planet-sized computers on which to run these virtual reality worlds where additional AIs would just be simulated beings in a simulated universe. Does that kind of make sense? If you're following along, it might not make sense.
Well, maybe I need to take some more drugs before I make any sense of this. Okay, so we talked a bit about the E and the S and the C parts of the acronym.
Yes.
But let's move on to the R, rationalism. What does that mean in this world?
I would just add very briefly, if I may, that at the heart of transhumanism is this imperative to radically re-engineer humanity, right? And so this is really at the heart of all of the other claims that test crewlists make, because we're probably not going to be able to colonize space if we don't radically re-engineer ourselves or upload our minds to computers or just create a new species of AGI to completely replace humanity, right? So that's the idea behind transhumanism. And rationalism was founded by a very noted figure within the modern transhumanist movement, Eliezer Yudkowsky. The idea was the following. Okay, if we're going to build a utopian world among the literal heavens, where these future beings live forever in perfect bliss, you know, there's no suffering because, you know, in their simulated worlds, nobody feels any pain. If we're going to realize that vision, then we're going to need a lot of quote unquote really smart people doing some really smart things, right? The idea behind or the motive behind rationalism is that perhaps we need to take a step back and think about the best ways to optimize our rationality. Because the more optimally rational we are, then the better positioned we are to create these post-human successors who will go out and colonize space. Rationalism is all about identifying cognitive biases in order to neutralize those biases. It's about developing new theories in a field called decision theory, which is supposed to enable us to make decisions in the most rational way possible. Some of that might sound good because all of us, or at least most of us, want to be more rational, and we don't want to succumb to the distorting effects of cognitive biases. But when you start to look at the details of what rationalism is all about, then it becomes really problematic. So I'll give you a very brief example. The founder, Yudkowsky, posted an article on his community blogging website, Less Wrong, which is the online epicenter of the whole rationalist community, in which he asked readers, okay, imagine a situation in which you are forced to choose between these two options. One is that a single individual is tortured mercilessly for 50 years. The other is that some unfathomable number of people suffer the almost imperceptible discomfort of having a speck of dust briefly in their eye. So which of these is worse? His argument was that the second, the dust speck scenario, is much worse because if you do the math,
this is insane material.
Yes. Yes, a guffaw is the appropriate response there, right? So if you do the math, like he literally has this little slogan, which is shut up and multiply. Forget about your like emotions, your moral feelings, you know, use your head, do the math, and then you'll see that the second scenario is much worse than somebody being tortured for 50 years. And therefore you should choose somebody being tortured for 50 years because that is the better of the two options.
I'm speaking with the philosopher Emil Torres. You mentioned very smart people doing very smart things, which touches on another aspect of this crew, which is a worship of IQ, a high IQ in particular, but also which touches upon something that infects this whole point of view as well, eugenics.
Yeah.
So could you talk about that angle, the IQ and the eugenics angles?
You're completely right that IQ is very, very important to a lot of people in the test crew movement. Many of them are, the term would be IQ realists. So they think IQ measures something real about the human mind and that this thing is very important. You know, a lot of psychologists, philosophers, and so on think IQ is complete nonsense, right? There was a really good critique of the idea of IQ by a statistician named Nassim Taleb. And he points out that IQ tests can potentially be useful for individuals who would score very low on IQ tests. But when it comes to people who are above average, it's just basically meaningless because there are a million different ways to be quote unquote intelligent. I mean, there's some people who are great at math, some people who have amazing common sense and wisdom. There are other people who, you know, are brilliant scientists, but have no common sense and no wisdom to share. It's just a million.
It's funny, the GI, the artificial general intelligence. But IQ is a kind of measure of a general intelligence, which really, as you're saying, doesn't really exist.
Yeah, that is absolutely my view. I would liken the idea of intelligence to the idea of skill. If somebody says, oh, you should meet my friend Joe, he's really, really skilled, just an incredibly skilled person. You'd be like, in what sense? In what way? I need more information.
Can he write a string quartet, or can he like cook a really nice dinner, or can he build a nice cabinet? Like, what is
exactly it? Exactly right. And so when somebody says, oh yeah, my you should meet my buddy, they're super intelligent, not in the sense of AGI, but they're very, very intelligent. That to me just means, it means nothing, right? I have no idea what to expect in the exact same way that you're describing. Is this really skilled person? Like, I don't know, are they great at like carpentry? Or like, are they an amazing painter? Historically then, the development of IQ tests was intimately bound up with eugenics. And it was developed by leading eugenicists, many of whom had deeply racist and very sexist views. So they believed that the white race, quote unquote, you know, had superior intelligence relative to other racial categories. And they developed the test to, it basically confirmed exactly what they wanted to show. There's this deeply racist history that IQ tests and the idea of IQ is intimately bound up with. I guess this brings us to eugenics. There is a very clear continuity between the eugenics movement of the 20th century and the emergence of the test grill movement. So for example, there are leading figures within the test grill movement who have sounded the alarm about the possibility of dysgenic pressures. So dysgenic is sort of the opposite of eugenic. Eugenic means good birth. Dysgenics would occur if, for example, individuals who are quote unquote less intelligent outbreed their quote unquote more intelligent peers. Right. So the idea is that intelligence is heritable, which is highly questionable from a scientific perspective. The idea is that intelligence is heritable. And hence, if there are a bunch of low IQ people who are having more children than high IQ people, then the prevalence of low IQ people within the population will increase over transgenerational time, right, across the generations. And so people in the test grill movement have explicitly worried about this. This is an idea that the eugenicists of the 20th century were completely freaked out about. What if it's the case that the non-white population in the US grows in size, right, if they outbreed the white population? Well, that could be really, really bad because of dysgenic pressures, because these racist IQ realists thought that non-white populations had lower IQs. The last thing I say about this is that transhumanism is uncontroversially a form of eugenics. In fact, transhumanism was initially introduced by some leading eugenicists of the 20th century, such as Julian Huxley, a biologist who published several books on this topic. One way of understanding transhumanism is that it is eugenics on steroids, right? So the old school eugenicists, they just wanted to improve the human species, right? To perfect the human species, to create the best version of us as possible. And again, part of that meant banning interracial marriages or preventing immigration. Right, this is all part of the old eugenics program, and those were seen as means for perfecting humanity. Transhumanism, in contrast, says why stop at perfecting humanity? Why not create an entirely new and quote-unquote superior post-human species? It's in this sense, with respect to the ultimate aims of old-school eugenics versus transhumanism, that transhumanism is eugenics on steroids.
This would all be a quirky mode of thought, except for the fact that people like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and Sam Altman and Marc Andreessen are, to varying degrees, part of this club. So how does this mode of thought relate to these Silicon Valley mockers?
Marc Andreessen actually had the descriptor test realist in his Twitter bio back in, I think it was probably 2023 or maybe late 2022, but a couple of years ago. So he has identified with the test grill movement. Elon Musk has said that long-termism is, quote, a close match for my philosophy.
And his colonizing Mars thing is totally part of this, too.
Absolutely. Yes. Musk sees himself as some kind of messianic figure who is going to play this absolutely pivotal role, not just in human history, but in cosmic history. Because if he is the one who ushers in the age of AGI with his company XAI, then that's going to be this monumental shift. It's going to introduce an entirely new capability for us to then go on to realize the techno-utopian vision of the test grill worldview, but also SpaceX. You're completely right. I mean, Mars is the stepping stone to the rest of the galaxy, which is the stepping stone to the rest of the universe, right? And so if he is the one to get us to Mars and enables us to establish Earth-independent colonies on Mars, then he will have launched us in the direction of realizing this utopian world, maybe more than anyone else on Earth right now. All of these people also embody, unfortunately, the same kind of deeply problematic discriminatory attitudes that animated the eugenics movement of the 20th century, right? So Elon Musk has warned about global population decline. If you look closely at some of his tweets, it seems that he's not merely worried about the population of humans around the entire world declining, but he's worried about white populations declining. So there was somebody who tweeted, this would have been several months ago, who tweeted that the white demographic globally is about 7% of the world population. And Musk replied to this. And his response was, and declining fast. I might not have gotten the exact words right, but that's essentially what he said. I think this reveals that there is very much a racial component to his anxiety about not just immigration, but population decline. He basically thinks that white people are superior, and hence it would be very bad for the world. It would be bad for the future of humanity / post-humanity if the white population were to decline.
In his long interview with Ross Douthat of the New York Times in June, Peter Thiel was asked by Douthat if he wanted the human race to endure. And then Thiel hemmed and hawed before reluctantly saying, yes, but it didn't seem like he really believed it. And then he brought up transhumanism in the next sentence or two. What is it these people want? Are they indifferent to or even welcoming of human extinction?
I think that this is one of the most important things for people to understand. In fact, I would say there are two really important things for people to understand about what's happening in Silicon Valley. One is that the Tescreel worldview is ubiquitous. In many ways, it's the water that these people swim in. It's the air that they breathe. So you just cannot understand what's going on in Silicon Valley, especially with respect to the race to build AGI, without some understanding of transhumanism, long-termism, and so on, all of these Tescreel ideologies. And the second really important thing for people to understand is that a key component of the utopian vision that's at the heart of Tescreelism is a pro-extinctionist stance. What does utopia look like? Well, it looks like a world in which post-humans, not humans, are the ones who run the show. They're the ones in charge who rule the world. And so there is a pro-extinctionist element that is really integral to the Tescreel movement. When Peter Thiel hesitated, he was just channeling this pro-extinctionist component of the Tescreel worldview. It's not humanity, it's post-humanity that is going to ultimately rule the world and go out and colonize space. And what's interesting is that Peter Thiel has a somewhat unique view that I think is kind of a minority within Silicon Valley, according to which the post-human beings that should eventually replace us, they ought to be extensions of our biological bodies, right? So he's explicitly said that he wants to live forever, but he also wants to keep his body, right? He doesn't want to upload his mind to a computer to become some digital being. This contrasts with the kind of pro-extinctionism, a slightly different version of pro-extinctionism that a lot of people in Silicon Valley accept. I would say a lot more people in Silicon Valley accept, according to which the future is digital, right? So you could sort of distinguish between Peter Thiel's biological transhumanism and what might be called digital eugenics. Digital eugenics is just a version of pro-extinctionism that says those future post-humans that replace us, they should all be digital in nature. Either they could be uploaded to human minds, or they could be entirely separate, autonomous, distinct entities, like ChatGPT is, right? So you could imagine ChatGPT 10 or whatever, achieving the level of AGI and then taking over, right? In this sense, AGI is not an extension of us, but it's something completely separate. You know, we didn't become it, we just created it. Whereas Peter Thiel, I think, has this vision of post-humanity as something that we become rather than create. So they're all different like versions of pro-extinctionism. But the key point here is that they're all pro-extinctionist.
Now, as you describe it, this does not sound like a popular agenda. So is there room for coercion in their worldview?
Oh, is there room for coercion? Yeah, I think so.
That was a deliberately naive question.
One thing I would say is that their vision of the future is not inclusive. It doesn't include humans. If it was an inclusive future, it would also include us. It doesn't. It's a future for post-humans. The other thing I would say is that it is deeply elitist. It's extremely undemocratic, right? So they, right now, with their billions and trillions of dollars, are trying to create a new world run by post-humans without ever having inquired about the opinions and preferences of the rest of humanity. They're doing this without our consent, and they don't really care one bit about what the rest of us have to say. They believe in their vision, and they're going to try to bring it about whether or not we fuss about it or protest. They truly believe that this is the right thing to be doing. You could describe this as profoundly coercive. It is so undemocratic, and there is just zero input from the rest of humanity about what the future, what our collective human future ought to look like. There's a colleague of mine named Monica Bilskita, and she has this great line. She's talking about the future of humanity, and she says, you cannot design for, you can only design with. Even if you are somebody who cares about the opinions and preferences of the rest of humanity, it's still not good enough to exclude people who represent the rest of the world in your whole process of building the future. The people in Silicon Valley are bad in a dual sense, because on the one hand, a lot of them, I think, just don't care one bit about what the rest of humanity wants. And then in addition, they haven't included representatives of all the different peoples and nations and traditions, et cetera, around the world. They haven't included those people in their activity of determining exactly what the future should look like and how we should go about developing it.
These Silicon Valley guys are the super intelligence for the moment. So who needs everyone else's opinion?
Exactly. I think that's what they believe. The rationalist community is very influential in Silicon Valley. And what the rationalist community basically tells its members is that once you've mastered this or that theory within the field of decision theory, once you've mastered the patterns of thought that are optimally rational, then your job is done. You then have a kind of direct access to fundamental truths about what the future ought to look like. And therefore, you do not need to go out and ask people what their opinion is, because rationality provides a universal perspective, a universal and objective perspective on the world. And so once you've obtained that universal objective perspective, then you don't need any other input from anyone else. And so I think that is exactly how these billionaires in Silicon Valley are thinking.
That was the philosopher Emil Torres. You can find their work on the web at xriskology, xriskology.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
I want to be software, upload my mind, take all my data, what will you find? I want to be software, binary heart, infinite options, state of the art. I want to be software.
Some of Grimes and Elangelo's I Want to Be Software from 2023. Next, a fiscal history of New York City and how we might do better. For much of the city's history, the approach has been to encourage the rich to live and do business here, and then hope that they generate enough tax revenue to pay the city's expenses. It wasn't always thus. In the early 19th century, New York City got revenue not only from taxes, but from enterprise, municipally owned utilities and markets. Those largely disappeared, but as some lonely voices have argued over the years, we could bring them back. Daniel Wortel London is just out with a book from the University of Chicago Press, The Menace of Prosperity, New York City and the Struggle for Economic Development, 1865 to 1981, that covers this history in fascinating detail. He is a visiting assistant professor of history at Bard College. Daniel Wortel London. Early on in the book, you make the point, which reoccurs throughout this text, is that the social costs of the wealthy often outweigh their positive effects on urban revenue. Could you just talk about that general principle? It sort of runs against conventional wisdom.
There's a few reasons. On the one hand, cities need to spend money to attract the wealthy often. In the case of New York, they went into debt often to build the kind of infrastructure that they thought the wealthy needed to relocate. And that often didn't pay for itself. So on the one hand, cities were subsidizing the wealthy. But on the other hand, the kind of industry cities were attracting often produced their own costs, things like pollution or traffic, or the industries themselves get into financial trouble and they need to get bailed out. And that creates more sort of disruption for cities and for their economies. So on the one hand, there's the costs of attracting and retaining businesses. And on the other hand, they're kind of externalities, which they put on the public and which the city needs to clean up, basically.
And also running through the book is a theme that really runs through a lot of our general political economy, is a confusion of economic growth with economic development. What do these two things mean and how are they different?
So I think of growth as a sort of quantitative metric where you're thinking about the amount of an activity or maybe the amount of revenue or GDP something is contributing to. But development is a little more qualitative, but it's often the things we value more, things like maybe education, well-being, health, happiness. And there's some level of correlation between these things, but often there isn't. And in the U.S., you've seen a growth in GDP, but a kind of flatlining of development by many indicators since the 1970s. And like I'm saying with social costs, you can have economic growth, but that's leading to a lot of cost. If you build a lot of jails or missiles, that could be leading to economic growth, but I'm not sure those are leading to a qualitative development, which is what we really want growth to achieve. And the problem often comes when we see growth as an ends rather than a means.
Early on in the book, you mentioned, somewhat in passing, but it's an interesting idea, the emergence of real estate as a thing. People didn't really think of real estate as a thing until, I guess, the early 19th century. Like, how did that happen?
Cities in America were not given a lot of power by the state governments, and they weren't allowed to tax what they wanted. They weren't often allowed to own their own businesses. They were allowed to tax property for their revenue. And people had been, at least white colonialists had been owning real estate in New York for a while. But as New York developed in the 19th century, the value of that land started to go up. And at the same time, Albany was preventing the city from entering into business for itself through public ownership.
Now, the city had some public ownership, right?
It had some of that earlier. So the city was able to buy and sell real estate on its own for a while. It was able to own markets and get some revenue from that. But by the early 19th century, the city's relying on property taxes. And it creates this kind of dependency where the city's dependent on real estate and by extension, real estate owners for revenue. And it becomes, in the city's interest to develop that real estate to encourage its development. And often that takes the form of giving real estate owners tax breaks or building infrastructure on their behalf, hoping that the property values rise and tax revenue goes up.
Beginning in the middle of the 19th century, we saw in New York City a lot of grand debt finance schemes to raise property values, to raise property taxes. It sounds almost like a familiar overture to the fiscal crisis that came 100 years later, but the 1873 fiscal crisis that hit with the Depression of 1873 was the undoing of that whole strategy. All the debt finance schemes turned out not to be very profitable, and the city was left stuck with debt. So what about that first crisis before the big famous one 100 years later?
In some ways, it's very similar through the 1860s, sort of like the 1960s, in fact. New York was engaged in a lot of debt financing on behalf of real estate. And this was something that Tammany Hall was doing. It was also something that a lot of the good government WASPy types were doing, too, when they were in office. In the 1870s, there's a crisis of real estate, of banking, all these things. One out of five American cities goes bankrupt during the 1870s crisis. This is occurring at a time of real working class ferment. There's all kinds of radical unions, radical labor organizing going on, and people interpret this fiscal crisis through that populist, artisanal, Republican lens. And they see it as a problem with speculation, as a problem of monopoly. And among many workers, there's a desire to bring back the economy to and return it to this kind of working class, productive orientation. And the biggest spokesperson for that is Henry George, who really comes out of the 1870s crisis with an explanation for it and a call to reorient and reconstruct urban economies.
I was struck by a quote from Richard Ely, one of the early professional economists. He said, American cities were routinely embarrassed by expenditures made at the solicitation of landowners, particularly on the occasion of booms, and not, as popularly imagined, by the moneyless rabble. You could apply that observation to the fiscal crisis of the 1970s. That was a not uncommon point of view after the bust of 1873, though, was it?
No, I mean, it wasn't that uncommon. Some of the first professional economists, like Richard T. Ely and Henry Adams, were very dismissive or contemptuous towards private real estate owners who were asking cities to go into debt on their behalf and then needed to be bailed out or saved once things went wrong. But you had, on the one hand, professional economists believing this. You also had a lot of working class people feeling like their cities were undergoing depression because of real estate speculation and the fiscal crises that came out of it. And you also had a lot of urban planners who were thinking that the way cities are developing based on speculation is irrational. It's leading to ugly cities, inefficient cities. And you get this kind of broad coalition between some of the professional middle class, working class people, even some homeowners who are all seeing real estate speculation and high land values as dampening local prosperity.
Now, this is also nationally a time of the Knights of Labor, the populist movement, cooperative movements. What were the local New York City manifestations of those broader movements?
So there were a lot of different attempts at building worker cooperatives around the country during the 1870s, 1880s. And these were meant not just to provide democratic workplaces, but to be more efficient than large monopolies. You would have under worker cooperatives basically production oriented to the needs of the workers and the communities where these cooperatives were based. And New York was one of the centers of these. There were dozens of cooperatives around New York in the 1870s and 1880s. And a lot of these cooperative efforts, you'd see it again in the 1910s and the 1930s and the 1960s. And it's there's a recurring move to reorient the productive enterprises of New York around worker ownership. And it really starts with a bang in this period after the fiscal crisis of the 1870s.
Fast forwarding through the last quarter of the 19th century, at the dawn of the 20th, there was a turn towards a philosophy of responsible capitalism, a more planned, even humane form, an elite adaptation to the radical movements like the socialists, the Knights of Labor, Henry George land tax schemes of the 1870s and 80s. I was surprised to learn that REBNY, the Real Estate Board of New York, the very powerful voice of the industry today, was founded in 1896. What happened in this shift? What were the development strategies that emerged?
On the one hand, you got groups like REBNY promoting real estate as not speculative, but based on science. And you get a host of new textbooks talking about how real estate values can be predicted and calculated in advance. And often this is promoted by mortgage loaners, real estate loaners, who want to figure out a way of predicting if they'll get paid back on their investments. So there's a sense we can make real estate a science. On the other hand, you get city government itself. You see reformers trying to make it more responsible, more trustworthy to bankers. And when you get the city looking more responsible to bankers, you can get loans from them for projects like subways and other infrastructure projects. And in a sense, debt becomes a substitute for the land value tax and for municipal ownership, because rather than relying on those other things to grow the city with all the radical consequences that might imply, the city can say, oh, we're just going to go to the bank and pay for the subway this way. And many working class people, they want a home. They don't really care how they get it. They're willing to go along with that. So the debt financing of the city dilutes the constituency for some of these other radical nostrums. And a lot of progressives, reformers to begin with, aren't that comfortable with, you know, Henry George's populism. And they see an economy based around top-down management and science as a lot more effective way of growing the city. And you're also seeing the depoliticization of development decisions. When New York forms as the greater city in 1898, you get things like the Board of Estimate and all these undemocratic committees that basically decide how the city should grow. And to a unnerving extent, that's still the case today. A lot of economic development decisions aren't made by city councils. They're made behind closed doors. And a lot of that does go back to the progressives, ironically.
I'm speaking with Daniel Wortel London, author of The Menace of Prosperity, just out from the University of Chicago Press. Time constraints forced me to cut some material here about the boom of the 1920s, which saw the development of both the outer boroughs and Manhattan office buildings that all crashed with the stock market in 1929. And now, let's pick up with the early post-World War II years. Now, coming out of World War II, there is a return to some old themes, subsidizing development in the interests of raising tax revenues. But it was a time when the city was seen as a white-collar engine. That was going to be what was going to drive growth, was office buildings and white-collar workers. They're happy to see manufacturing leave. It was not just a force from outside. It was something that the development establishment was encouraging. What was the development strategy in those early post-war decades?
During the Depression, a lot of landlords got bailed out by the federal government, but the city fathers did not want to return to that. And a lot of them recognized that relying on real estate growth alone was not a stable way of financing the city. And before the Depression, there had been different theories of real estate. Some of them are based on the accessibility of a parcel as the guarantor of its value. But during the 30s, a lot more people focus on income. What's the maximum amount of income that could be generated on a parcel? And those income-producing activities are the economic base of cities. And after the Depression, that income-based model becomes the guiding star of a lot of cities. What's the maximum income generating activity that we can attract here? And a lot of people just look to the white collar sector. I mean, it seems sort of obvious. They're the ones making the most money. And before the 30s, cities hadn't really thought too much in depth about what are the kind of industries we want to attract? How do we tailor our particular development strategies to meet this group rather than that group? It was all kind of assumed that if you build infrastructure, they will come. But by the 1940s and 50s, you're seeing a lot more fine-grained attention to detail from cities on, we want to attract white-collar industries. What do these industries need? What does their population need? Let's try attracting them in this way. That model of attracting white-collar industries, it predates the 1980s. It goes back to the post-Depression era.
You don't have much to say about the 1975 fiscal crisis. Roten's name doesn't even appear. But coming out of it, there was a remarkable impoverishment of thinking about how to achieve real prosperity. What was the predominant thinking and what was missing?
Through the 1960s, under the height of great society liberalism, people like Mayor Lindsay were assuming you can pay for a large welfare state by taxing the wealthy. During the fiscal crisis, a lot of conservatives were saying the solution is lower taxes on the wealthy and gut the welfare state. Liberals would say we need to keep the welfare state, but they agreed we need the wealthy here to pay for it. This was sort of a missed opportunity because neither of them think we need to change the city's economy. Now, there were some people in the New Left, some Black power advocates, and even Jane Jacobs, to a certain extent, were talking about different models of the economy, a model sort of harkening back to the 1870s. They're talking about worker cooperatives, public ownership, some of these other initiatives. But frankly, the shock and speed of the fiscal crisis made a lot of their efforts more defensive. They wanted to retain New York's generous welfare state, and they were a little less interested in rethinking the economy. Other people were saying, you know, we need the federal government to bail us out. In the 1870s, those were not options. There was not a welfare state or a federal government to bail out the city back then. And so people, in some sense, needed to think of other strategies like economic reconstruction or alternative development strategies as a solution. But in the 1970s, a lot of people on the left were interested in retaining what they had because they had built up so much rather than these alternatives. Also, the racial dimension is crucial here. You had a large population of white homeowners and a larger population of Black people in the city than there had been in the 1870s. And the fiscal crisis becomes racialized in a new kind of way, where, oh, it's the fault of these welfare-dependent Black people. And the fault is not with, let's say, the monopolists and the corporate drones who helped lead us to the problem. The window for thinking differently, diagnosing and coming up with alternatives for the fiscal crisis, the window is a little narrower in the 1970s than it had been before.
And then as a strategy to recover from the crisis, we went back to subsidizing office and white-collar growth.
Yeah, and one way of thinking of this is it's, you know, in the 1920s, the city had tried to borrow time by borrowing money. In the 1930s, the city had bought time by getting money from the federal government. And in the post-70s period, it's borrowing time by relying on the finance sector as its base, where the city is acting as a kind of octopus sponge, where it's being kept aloft by taking money from elsewhere around the country and from the pockets of its own citizens. So you're getting a commitment to buying time for the city, but not trying to build up a new middle class or a strong working class from within its population as its economic base. And instead, you're getting this kind of pyramid model of the economy where you're just hoping that by taxing the top 1%, it'll trickle down.
Towards the end of the book, I started thinking about the final line of Portnoy's complaint. Now we can really begin, huh? Having dismissed, you know, conventional economic development strategies, you hint at what you think might be a better idea, but would have been nice to see some more. So what ideas would you propose as an alternative to this conventional model? What's another approach to managing the city's economy that would be more just and more sustainable?
Probably one of the more important places to begin is just how we think of a city's economy. You can imagine it as a bucket where there's a lot of holes in it, and the money that's made in the city is going out the holes into the pockets of different people or going outside the city in general. So I think if you're trying to reimagine the city's economy, we're trying to plug those leaks and keep the money local and trying to invest it where it's most needed. Probably one of the keystones of this is the public bank. And there's groups in the city, the New Economy Project in particular, who are saying, look, the city has billions of dollars in deposits with private banks that are putting their money in extractive projects, polluting projects, projects that will benefit the wealthy and not the majority. If that money is put into public banks, the city can reinvest it in ways that will build up its economy and not just siphon money out of it. The same principle applies towards worker cooperatives in the city, community land trusts, and forms of housing like social housing, nonprofit housing, where, again, money is being redistributed to the people who live in the city, to the tenants, to the workers, and keeping money in circulation rather than being spent out and into speculative and non-productive areas. The degrowth and growth debates, kind of like the abundance, yimby nimby debates, there's a lot there. I think all the sides have some truths there, but we need to see development in our cities. We need people to have jobs. We need people to have housing. and Zoran, God willing, he becomes mayor, he's able to deliver in material, concrete terms some of those things for people and show there's another way of doing business in this city. And I think, you know, hitting the ground running on some of this will be very important for him and for this broader cause.
You've anticipated my final question. It's been stunning to see his rise and a marvelous thing. Do you see a seriously new direction there of the sort you're talking about?
The most obvious case is the municipal groceries, where you're showing how an alternative business model can deliver the goods more effectively than the for-profit sector. I think that's important. But the profit is the key thing here. The boldest advocates of municipal ownership were saying, we want the city to go into business. We want it to actually generate profits and not depend on taxing the wealthy alone for revenue. Because as we've seen, relying on them comes with a whole bunch of problems. If Zoran is able to talk about taxing the rich and then using that money to become less dependent on the rich, that would be a key step here. I think the other thing is using the city's existing revenue and spending on economic development decisions in new ways. The city already spends a lot of money to promote economic development. It has a lot of tax expenditures it uses. Using that in new ways to reconstruct the economic base will be important. And finally, transparency. Economic development decisions in the city often happen behind closed doors. Things like tax expenditures, where the city is sort of writing off property taxes for select developers, those often don't appear on the budget. And those often aren't debated in city councils. So I think if Zoran is able to politicize those things and talk about alternatives, that would, be going a long way towards this kind of new model.
That was Daniel Wartell London, author of The Menace of Prosperity, just out from the University of Chicago Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Soltame, which the internet tells me is Argentine Spanish for Let Go of Me, new from the Argentinian duo Pacifica. No relation to this network. Till next week, bye.
You've been glued to that phone for like a half an hour. What's going on?
Just keeping up with the news. Doing my research.
Okay. And what's the word out there, Mr. Research?
Man, I don't even know. It's like wars, hurricanes, billionaires tweeting at each other. Or is it Xing now? Robots stealing jobs. Robots with machine gun heads. AI girlfriends. Wait, is TikTok banned again or not?
Wow. A masterclass in knowing everything and understanding nothing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Let's skip the chaos buffet and let KPFA feed you with actual news and context.
Oh, wow. So I don't have to decode memes to know what's real?
Exactly. KPFA. News and current events without the nonsense.
94.1.
Hi, this is Alice Walker. In these difficult times, I can't imagine living in a world without KPFA. Please donate what you can today.
Hi, this is Jeff Chang. For years, KPFA has been a beacon for all of us in times of political darkness and lack of hope. Let's stand with KPFA now. Please donate what you can today.
Hi, folks. This is Rebecca Gordon. We're living through some pretty hard times these days, and I can't imagine doing it without KPFA. Please donate whatever you can today. Thank you.
Donate today by calling 1-800-439-5732 or online at kpfa.org.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley,
88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org.